Good evening. Once again, it's wonderful to see you out this evening. I would like to thank Brother Robert for his prayer in mentioning that this evening, as always when I stand before you, that we are going to be studying together. At least that's my goal. Not simply that you're listening to a sermon or listening to me lecture, but that you have, from your perspective, set out to study from God's Word. And while I may be leading that study, that you're opening your Bibles, you're following along, you're looking at God's Word as well as I am, keeping me in check, and you're looking for application in your own life so that you might draw closer to God and greater serve Him. I thank Him for His prayer and for those who have led and participated in worship. I've been uplifted by our songs, and I look forward to studying for a few moments from God's Word. I have always had a great love for the Old Testament, and the more often you hear me, you're going to hear a lot of sermons from the Old Testament because it was ingrained into my mind when I was very young, and I have a great love for it. There's just so many wonderful lessons for us there that we can see God working in people's lives. And one of my favorite reasons for the Old Testament, I really love the accounts of the heroes of old. You really see in the Old Testament God's power shown in a very unique way as you read about God's interaction and His divine intervention in the life of some of those heroes of old. And also because I'm a fan of the underdog. I don't know about you guys, but I'm a fan of the underdog. A particular sporting event that comes to mind was a playoff game, 1995, it was Game 1 in the NBA, Knicks versus Pacers, and you may remember this particular event, but the Indiana Pacers were down by 7 points, I believe, with 18 seconds left, and the game was all but over. And Reggie Miller came back, scored 8 points in 18.7 seconds, and the underdog in that game came back and actually won. And as you read through the Old Testament, what you find is a story just over and over and over of underdogs, people who are up against impossible odds, but yet through the power of God, they are able to come out victorious. They are able to come out on top. This evening we're going to study one of those stories, one of those accounts about a very one-sided battle, if you will. That is the story of the Battle of Jericho. And naturally, I wanted to think the walls came tumbling down prior to the lesson, but we weren't able to find that in the book. But the title of this evening's sermon is Victory by Grace. What we're going to find out as we study this evening is that no matter how things may be stacked against you, by the grace of God, you can prevail. If you remember up to this point, and we're going to be spending a lot of time in our Old Testaments, particularly the book of Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua, we'll be looking at various passages from there, and I have those listed. But if you remember just what's been taking place, previously the children of Israel had escaped Egyptian captivity, and by the power of God, through Moses who led them out, they've been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, whenever they prepared to enter into the city of Jericho to take that land that God had promised them, you can see there to the east side of the Jordan. That's where they'd be camped. The Jordan River just runs down there. They were camped on the east side of the Jordan, and Jericho right there is the first city that they're going to come to after they cross over the Jordan River. As we look at this account, one of the things that very obviously comes to mind is that the children of Israel faced an insurmountable enemy. Like every underdog, they faced an insurmountable enemy. I'm looking firstly at Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 1, if you'd like to turn over there and follow along as we study together this evening. Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 1, this is actually Moses' message to the Israelites prior to their crossing over to begin the conquest of the land of Canaan that God had promised them. Look at what Moses tells the children of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 1. Hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan today and go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourselves, cities great and fortified up to heaven. Now, I don't know if Moses was trying to give them a pep talk, but if I were a coach, that's not what I begin by telling my people. Moses is saying, you're going to cross over this Jordan River, and the people you're going to encounter are going to be greater than you, more numerous than you, and more powerful than you. And what Moses then seeks to do, he sends these 12 spies into the land of Canaan for 40 days.
What we find out is that even though God was going to give them this land, that was a promise he made, God was going to give them this land, there was some involvement on behalf of the children of Israel. There was some effort that they had to put forth. They go, they spy out the land, they bring back their report, and they give that Numbers chapter 13. In Numbers chapter 13, we'll read a couple of verses there. These 12 spies, one man from every tribe, were sent across. Beginning in verse 28, they give the report after they go into that land. They're there for 40 days. They come back and they tell Moses and the people what they see. Numbers chapter 13, verse 28, the people say, the spies came back and said, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak, that is referring to the giants, the lineage of giants. Verse 31, the men who had gone up said, we are not able to go against the people, for they are stronger than we. What we find out is a report that these spies brought back regarding the land of Canaan was one that frightened the people. Jericho was a very heavily fortified city. I want you to consider for a moment and appreciate what the children of Israel were up against. My perception of Jericho, and I guess it's always been so, is that Jericho was a city that was surrounded by a huge wall, is how I always envisioned it, kind of like a castle, and you had this huge outer wall that was impenetrable from any army. However, there was an archaeologist by the name of Kathleen Kenyon who excavated the city of Jericho in the 1950s. And she gives a description of what she found after she goes and she excavates there. And this is a more realistic image of the wall that was surrounding the city of Jericho. Let me just read this description that she gave regarding her findings of the city of Jericho and its walls that surround it. The mound, or the tail of Jericho, was surrounded by a great earthen rampart or embankment with stone retaining wall at its base. The retaining wall was some 4 to 5 meters, that is 12 to 15 feet, and you can see there the little image that he gives of the men standing down. That retaining wall, 12 to 15 feet high, on top of that was a mud brick wall, 6 feet thick and 6 to 8 meters high, so that's an additional 20 to 26 feet. At the crest of the embankment was a similar mud brick wall whose base was roughly 14 meters, 46 feet high, above the ground level outside the retaining wall. This is what loomed high above the Israelites as they marched around the city for 7 days. This is not what I had in mind. But you can see, as you imagine here, the city of Jericho and its people being completely and utterly protected by these multiple impenetrable walls. Now, they didn't have the technology. The Israelites did not have the technology that we do today. And Jericho, also, as we are going to see, was designed to withstand a siege. That is, they were designed, the city was designed so that if it was surrounded by enemies, that they might be able to withstand and outlast their enemies. You look at a couple of more passages in the book of Joshua, going to Joshua chapter 2, verse 10. After hearing what had taken place, what the children of Israel had done, Jericho is going to begin to fortify themselves as a city in preparation for the Israelites' attack. Israel had swept through Egypt, they destroyed the Egyptians, they battled the giants, they defeated the giants, and they know, Jericho knows, that as they cross that Jordan River, that they're going to be the first ones on Israel's hit list. And so they begin preparing at that point in time, Joshua 2 and verse 10. This is the people speaking, and Rahab speaking to the spies, for we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea, for when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, the giants, who you utterly destroyed. They heard what Egypt had been done to Egypt. They heard what had been done to the Amorites. And in chapter 6 and verse 1, what we find out as they get ready to engage in warfare against Jericho, that Jericho was shut up because the children of Israel, none went out and none went in. So they were preparing for a siege. Now within that city also, there was discovered a spring that would have provided water. And in our class this morning, we were looking at how the waterway that Hezekiah dug allowed water to come in the city. And what that was for the Israelites, if they were surrounded, to withstand the siege, because water would be one of the things that they would run out of first. So the water that was there that flowed into the city provided for them a source of drink in the event that they were surrounded and they could outlast their enemies. This is also the case in the city of Jericho. Within Jericho, there was a spring that brought water in that was designed to help them withstand the siege as well. Not only that, but if you look, and it's kind of interesting to see how the Bible once again coincides with archaeological findings in chapter 3 and verse 15, or chapter 6, I believe it is, in verse 15, that the people had recently harvested their grain, and whenever this woman Kathleen Kenyon was over there, and she was discovering and excavating various things, that she found these jars that had food in them. That is when Jericho was destroyed, but they had food stocked up. These jars were full of grain so that they could outlast the siege. Jericho possibly could have lasted many years against a siege from the enemies. And if you consider who their attackers were, the children of Israel, a nation preparing for a siege would require a vast number of things. Essentially, the way that it would work, you would surround the city, and then you would essentially try to outlast them. You try to cause their water supplies to dry up, them to exhaust their food, and then they have no choice but to either let you into the city and submit, or to just die off, and then you're able to take the city. The children of Israel were the ones that were attacking. They would have surrounded the city. Now, the children of Israel, if you consider where they were, they wouldn't have the resources, the food, the water that many nations would have engaged in. The children of Israel were a bunch of vagabonds that had just escaped Egyptian bondage, and they had been wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. They were in no position to engage in a siege against the well-equipped Jericho. So as you consider the odds that they faced, by physical, manly, worldly standards, there is absolutely no way the children of Israel stood a chance in looking at this opponent. You would look at that and you would say, okay, Jericho is going to win this battle, hands down, as you consider the preparation of both armies. But what we found out in the song that we sang is that although they were faced with an insurmountable army, the battle belonged to the Lord. That's what we find out. I'm turning back to Numbers chapter 13, if you'd like to look over there with me. Numbers chapter 13, I'd like to read again a few passages. This is, once again, the report of the 12 spies as they came back regarding their findings. Numbers 13, verses 28 and 29, the report they brought back. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. And we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains of the Canaanites, dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Verse 31, if you will. The men who had gone up against them said, we're not able to go against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw there are men of great stature. We saw the giants, the descendants of Anak there, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept all night. By and large, this was the reaction of the Israelite people after hearing about the enemy that they were going to face. The spies came back. The cities are walled. They're large. They're fortified. These people, they're stronger than we are. Not only that, but they're giants in the land. Their armies have giants fighting for them. See, these spies, these 10 spies, came back with a negative report with essentially the perspective that they were looking at this problem without God. They were looking at this problem as if they themselves were going to go over there and they were going to fight these people. The Israelites were basically a bunch of vagabonds, and they're going to make war on cities that had weaponry and fortifications and armies and devised tactics and strategies and weapons of warfare, and they knew on their own they didn't stand the chance. But it's interesting to see God's response in Joshua 6, and this is prior to the taking of this city. Joshua chapter 6, verse 2, as God comes and as he speaks to Joshua, because he knows what the children of Israel were up against, he offers Joshua these words. See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. Something Israel should have learned was that their enemies were not going to be defeated by their own power. They only had to think back to the land of Egypt and how God had delivered them by a mighty hand through the plagues and the destruction of the powerful Egyptian army. He essentially brought a band of slaves and destroyed one of the most powerful empires at that time. They did really nothing other than simply comply with the conditions that he set. They should have known that it wasn't going to be by their own might alone that they were going to defeat Jericho. As they considered the plagues in Egypt, and then the Red Sea is spread open, and they're able to walk across on dry land. That cloud of fire, that cloud that led them by day, the pillar of fire, should have been a reminder that God was with them. We sit back and we criticize the children of Israel for lacking faith, but how many times have we been guilty of the same thing? How many times have we looked at our problems, and as we consider them from simply the purely physical perspective, say, there's no way that I can do this. There's no way that I can overcome. There's no way that I can outlast this. Joshua chapter 1, in verses 6 through 9, God reiterates His promise to Joshua. Be strong and of good courage. And it says, be strong and courageous three times. Because He knows what Joshua is going up against. He knows what these people are going up against. Be strong and courageous. For this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to them to give them. Only be strong and very courageous that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn to it from the right hand to the left that you may prosper wherever you go. The book of law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night that you may observe to do all that is in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and have good courage. God reiterates His promise to Joshua that He made to Moses, that He made to their forefathers. They may be the underdogs. It may not look like they have a chance in the world, but they have the power of God on their side. And so, in Joshua chapter 6, we see Joshua laying out the battle plan, or rather I should say God laying out the battle plan to Joshua, how this great city was going to be taken. In Joshua chapter 6, beginning in verse 3, He tells Joshua, you shall march around the city. All you men of war, you shall go all around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And the seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram horns before the ark. But the seventh day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great voice, and the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man before them. God lays out His battle plan. The previous generation had fallen prey to a very humanistic way of thinking. It was a generation that wandered in the wilderness because God was purifying His people. He was getting rid of those that lacked faith, that lacked courage, that rebelled against Him, preparing for Himself a generation that was prepared to trust Him and enter into this city up against impossible odds, because they would have understood that the battle belonged to the Lord. And what we find out as we finish reading the story is that victory is obtained not by the power of the Israelite army, not by the ingenuity of their generals and their leaders, but Israel is able to be victorious by the grace of God. That's what we see taking place as you read through the actual battle as it happens in Joshua 6, beginning in verse 12. Joshua rose early in the morning. The priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram horn before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came across after the ark, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And on the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did 6 days. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early after the dawning of the day. They marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only, they marched around the city 7 times. The seventh time it happened, when the priests blew the trumpet, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And in verse 20, the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpet. And it happened, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, that the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then every man went on, ran up straight away and took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, oxen, sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. And so what we see is the children of Israel are victorious. Now you may wonder, where is grace involved in all of this? We said that they receive victory by grace, but where is grace involved? Grace is, simply as we define it, unmerited favor. And primarily when we think of grace, we think of it in terms, in its salvific sense, or how it pertains to salvation. We think of God's unmerited favor to us through the giving of His Son. Where do we see grace in this story? Did the Israelites deserve this victory that they received? Did they outmaneuver and outwit and by their power and their might overcome this opponent? Now what we find out in Deuteronomy 6 verses 10 and 11, God once again speaking to Moses, He says, "It shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of Israel, which He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, to give you a large and beautiful cities which you did not build. He's going to give you houses full of good things which you did not fill. He's going to give you hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, when you have eaten and then are full." What was going to happen was God was going to give, as He said to the Israelites, these cities that they did not deserve and that they did not earn, these wells that they did not dig, these trees that they did not plant. We see there are God's unmerited favor because the Israelites did nothing to deserve this victory. Their victory against Jericho was no different. It was not deserved, and it was won simply by the grace of God. The story reveals to us an important aspect of grace. Even if grace is conditioned by obedience, what we find out in this story, grace is still grace. Just because there are conditions that we have to comply with, as there were conditions the Israelites had to comply with, grace remains grace even if conditioned by obedience. What did God command the people to do? There in Joshua 6, He promises His reward in verse 2. The Israelites had a part to play. They had something that they had to do. They weren't just given the city without doing anything. They had to make these trumpets. They had to march around the city 6 days. They had to blow on these trumpets. They had to, on the seventh day, walk around 7 times, blow the trumpets. And they had to have faith in God. That was what was required of them. Now, despite the fact they had all these conditions and they did all of these things, it was still grace that gave them the city, was it not? I would have liked to have sat down as Joshua pitched this plan to his general. As the generals, no doubt, would have been anxious to hear, "Okay, Joshua, how are we going to take this great city?" And as Joshua calls them together, he says, "Okay, here's me going to march around the city. I'm going to blow the same thing. They say something different. We're going to blow these trumpets." And then he was conveying, it made much sense this was foolish. And what we found, because of faith and because of grace, doing what God commanded them to do did not make them deserving of their victory. Rather, their victory was solely achieved by the grace of God, which He conditioned with their obedience. And there's a lesson in this for you and I. Just as we consider the enemy of the children of Israel being insurmountable, that is, they could not overcome, our enemy is insurmountable as Christians. I'm turning to Isaiah chapter 59, verses 1 and 2 there. We face an enemy as we are here in this life, and faith, nor his ear heavy that it cannot bend, separates us from God. When we make the decision to willfully transgress commands that are given to us in God, vanish a lot. And that's an absolutely tragic thing. Romans chapter 1, Paul's description of the state of man whenever sin enters into their life is fearful. As it is written in Romans 3, 10-12, "There's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands. There's none who seeks after God. They've all turned aside. They've all together become unprofitable. There's none who does good, no, not one." And he goes on to say in chapter 3, verse 23, that sin occurs in all of our lives. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. What we find out is that our enemy is sin. And as you consider Romans 6:23, the wages, the reward of sin is death. Brethren, that's something that we cannot overcome. When I sin against God, there is no going back. There's no undoing what I did. No matter how much good I may do, my transgression cannot be made right quickly. We, like the Israelites, need to realize the battle is not ours, but the battle belongs to the Lord. You ever try to conquer your own problems? You ever tried to overcome your own sin? Perhaps through your own deeds of righteousness and your own keeping of the law, you say, okay, I'm going to be the Christian I need to be. I'm going to keep the book by the letter, the law by the letter. I'm not going to sin, and that might compensate for some of the wrong that I've done. That's what the Jews struggled with. They sought salvation through perfect keeping of the old law. You read through the book of Romans and the book of Galatians and the book of Hebrews, and what you find out is that is not possible. And as God says to Israel, found in Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 10, I love the sentiments that Paul expresses here. Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 6. For when we were still with a righteous man, will one die? Yet perhaps for a good man, someone would dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love toward us, that while we were still sinners, much more than having been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from wrath through Him. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. You find your condition here when we sin. And I find my condition here when we sin. Verse 6 says, Jesus died for me. But it's interesting to see when Jesus died for me. When I was without strength, when I, on my own power and my own good works, was without strength to save myself, Jesus died for me. He intervened, God intervened by the giving of His Son because He understood that we were hopeless, that we stood no chance. Sin was an instrument of the battle to our own kindness, our own love, but rather it's through the blood of Jesus Christ that we were saved. And God saved us in verse 10. Now when we came to Him, recognizing our sin, begging and pleading and recognizing our need, while we were enemies with God, when we stood opposed to God, whenever those people were there, they surrounded the cross, they were mocking Jesus, they were laughing at Him, they said, we win, you lose, you're going to die, you're nothing but a blasphemer. Jesus died to save those people while they were sinners. And Jesus died to save me while I was at enmity with God. And so the battle is not ours, but the battle belongs to the Lord. And what we find out is that battle is accomplished and won. And look at those Israelites won in defeating those of Jericho, not through their own ability or their own talent, but rather by the grace of God. In Ephesians 2 says, it is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. We have victory because of God's unmerited favor for you and for me. This passage is often mentioned by faith alone, and that it excludes all works in the minds of many people because, hey, it's the grace of God that saves us. Consider the account of Israel in the Battle of Jericho. To them, was their victory by faith alone? Did those walls fall down where we said, okay, we believe that God's going to give us this city? We believe, and that's all there is to it. And the walls fell down. That's not what happened. God set the conditions. They complied with the conditions. Those walls fell. They received the grace of God. They achieved victory, not by belief only. I want to share with you a quote from a man named David Burkott, who wrote a book called Will the Real Heretic Please Stand Up? And if you've never read it, quite an interesting read. He is a member of some denomination. But yet he's challenged many of the core beliefs of the denomination that he is a part of in standing for things, obedience in regard to the involvement of God for salvation, and you have absolutely no part. But he says, Augustine, Luther, and other Western theologians have convinced us that there is an irreconcilable difference, conflict, between salvation based on grace and salvation conditioned on works or obedience. They use a fallacious form of argumentation known as the false dilemma by asserting that there are only two possibilities regarding salvation. It's either one, a gift from God, or it's something we earn by works. The early Christians would have replied that it is a gift. A gift is no less a gift simply because it's conditioned on obedience. The fact that the gift is conditioned on our obedience doesn't change the fact that it is still a gift. The early Christians believed that salvation is a gift from God, but that God gives this gift to whoever He chooses, and He chooses to give it by obedience. Such is the case for His grace today. Some may say of members of the church, well, you just, what good am I having it? I need to obey it. And that's all there is to it. help us really understand this point in closing. Consider here the condition, victory by grace. As we look at Joshua and the account there, God set these conditions for the children of Israel in Joshua 6. He said, march around the city 7 times, make a long blast on your trumpets, shout with a great shout. Those are the conditions that God set. And then by grace, unmerited favor, the wall fell down flat. The conditions that God places on us today. Mark 16:16, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's the condition. And then by grace, we find out the result, that we will be saved. You see the parallel right there in Joshua 6? It's kind of simple how God works. And as you look at those two accounts, what we find out is God's the same today that He was thousands of years ago. And just because He may condition His grace Jesus died on the cross. He was raised from the grave. He was victorious over death. The battle's been fought. The war's been fought. And it's already been won. We can partake of victory by trusting in the grace of God through faith. And He will save us. If you're here this evening and you need to take that step, you need to be added to the Lord's church through obedience, through faith, through baptism, you can take that first step this evening. We would be happy to assist you in that. Or if you're here and perhaps you've been looking for solutions to problems in your life on your own, I hope that you realize that victory in life cannot be achieved through our own good works, through our own efforts. But you've got a body of brothers and sisters here that love you, that will pray for you, that will encourage you as you function in any way. Please do so at this time as we stand and as we sing.